You pressed play on this podcast with the click of curiosity. It is another dimension, a dimension of mind, a dimension where nothing is sacred and everything is explainable. You're streaming into a land of both inside and outside, of things and ideas. You've just crossed over into the midside.
Welcome to the midside, where we're still somehow doing this. I'm your host, Justin M. Lesneski, the hopeful bromantic, and I retroactively and proactively denounce anything anyone has ever said and ever will say on this show. Retroactively, of course, across over a decade, because this is now the 12th season premiere. This is then the 12th year we are doing this show, which is absolutely insane.
That's not counting the lost years, right, with the doctor. So we've been doing this.
Well, there was only like six episodes of that. So that was like, it's sort of like a lost season, but it's like a half season. Those episodes are hanging around.
That's
somewhere.
The pilot season, right? We got picked up mid seasons. So
yeah, this originally started as sort of like, hey, I'm living in California now and I'm not allowed to say what I think, or everyone's going to tell me I'm evil and I'm going to be canceled. And now that's become the entire culture. So I don't know. This just sort of became the place to go to point out how everything is absurd, point out all the farce. And we're going to talk about that a little bit, about peak farce, peak woke. But first, a few updates on life outside the midside. Or I guess you're always living in the midside. It's just you guys come to the midside once a week, but I'm here permanently. So
some of us never leave. It's like the Hotel California.
That makes it sound like drugs, and I'm straight edge, so I'm going to say it's not like the Hotel California. I would say it's more like the Hollywood Tower Hotel.
There you go.
To make a Disney Orlando reference. William, should I start with the good news or the bad news?
Let's start with the good news. Let's start off the year on a good note.
Okay. So we decided to take a couple extra weeks break this year so I could finish up wrestling season, which I'm really thankful that we made that decision. I'm thankful for all of you being patient, because I've been exhausted all the way through this past week, because the state tournament was the 29th of February. This is indeed a leap year. Hope everyone used that extra day wisely. Although, is it actually an extra day mathematically, William? I don't think it is, right? It's just...
Yeah, it is. Because we get a quarter, it's a quarter day extra over 4 years, right? So we just charge it. We just account for it on this day. So it kind of feels like an
extra
day.
Oh, we just account for it.
Yeah. Yeah.
Okay. So it's some of that time is relative nonsense we love to do as humans.
Yeah.
And then it was the 29th. The first and the second was the state tournament. Then rolled into the last day of the quarter, which is emotionally exhausted because students have a hard time wanting to do work. So that last week before the end of the quarter was, hey, you guys are going to fail this class, which... it's a skill to learn not to be too emotionally invested, but to be emotionally invested enough to help them. So the season finished up, and I think I finally recovered because I slept in super extra because I was losing the hour anyway due to daylight savings time, due to springing forward. Results of the season.
Yeah.
Finished first in the conference again, second in the district, fourth in the region, and 20th in the state.
Congratulations.
I was able to get four girls to qualify for state, and two were state placers. So not a great season, but it's important to remember that last year I graduated seven girls, and all of my state placers graduated. So I was basically starting over from ground zero, except for one girl who qualified and didn't place last year. She did place this year. So I was starting over from ground zero. So to remain top 20 in the state when it's basically a whole new team, I think that that is a success. All right, William, you want the bad news now?
Yeah, what's the bad news?
So, as if I didn't need more stress and I wasn't already tired in this last week where I was recovering, this is the first episode I am recording without any of the podcasts. So, Unfortunately, River's sister Echo passed this past week. The most difficult thing about it is she was very, very healthy and doing very, very well. And then over the past couple weeks or so, past month or so, she just stopped eating as much and wasn't really going to the bathroom. And so brought her to the vet a few times, brought her to Vetco, brought her to a local vet, tried to figure out some stuff. And it just, one morning she passed away after I left for school. And I thought she was going to live much longer. She was going to be 15 this summer. Remember, River died during the pandemic, September 2020. So she outlived her sister by about 4.5 years. Right, no, 3.5 years. Sorry, math is not my strong suit. But it's still weird. The weirdest thing, and William, I know you lost.
Yeah, Colt, about a year ago.
Recently.
Yeah, about a year ago.
Yeah.
But just coming up.
I don't know what it was like for you, but one of the warning signs for me was her entire life, even back in Clemson, 2009, when I first found her, her and her sister, River and Echo, would always come to the door when I got home. Well, she stopped coming to the door when I got home, and that was my first sort of warning sign where I was like, her behavior has changed. But now that she's gone, my brain still, because it's only been a few days, still thinks of her. And what I mean by that is, when I come home, my brain's still like, oh, I wonder where Echo is. And it's like an uncontrollable thought.
Yeah.
It's not like something I'm actively thinking about. It's just what my brain does. Oh, is Echo going to come to the door or not? Or is Echo on the couch? Or when I go downstairs, right? When I go downstairs, there was a spot she was always sitting in. It's like, oh, going to see Echo. Or when I would record the podcast all last season, she would lay next to me on the floor. And sometimes she would try and hop on the laundry bin, which is next to me because I record in my closet. Because, you know, I'm in the closet here. And she'd try to hop on that to be able to get closer to me. And my first thought when I was rearranging stuff was, oh, I need to make sure, because there was a box she stepped on once that she almost fell in because the top wasn't stable. My first thought automatically was, oh, I got to make sure that it's safe for Echo. And then I was like, God damn it, brain. Why do you keep doing this to me?
Yeah.
And it's really interesting because it shows how much of our thought processes and our brains like to become programmed, if that makes sense. And it shows probably why it's difficult for human beings to change and why people get stuck in these loops. People give them programs and formulas to follow and they just follow them. I don't know if you had any sort of similar experience with
Colt. I definitely did. You know, Colt's health was poor for a while, but same thing when he stopped eating, that was days before he passed, you know, when he stopped eating. And that was something that he never refused to treat, right? Like never, never, never.
Right.
And so when he stopped, you know, I was using treats to help motivate him to stand up because he was definitely in a lot of pain, but he needed to stand up and walk around. When he just wouldn't take a treat at all, like not even to try and trick me to take the treat and then not stand up, I was like, okay, something's wrong. We're getting close to the end. And then on the automatic thoughts, yeah, they're like, because I was doing so much to like help him carry him up and down the stairs, things like that. When I kept going up and down the stairs to do laundry and stuff like that, I would be like, oh, where's Colt? I want to make sure he doesn't try to follow me because he would fall because he wasn't strong enough to go down the stairs. So if he was upstairs or downstairs, he would try to follow me because he would always follow me. And I was constantly tracking him and I kept tracking him even though he was gone. I was like, I know he's gone. Why do I keep thinking I better see where Colt is, make sure he's not coming up the stairs, you know, or whatever. I kept doing that over and over again. I think it helped, you know, it's, you know, March is when we lost, when Colt died, and then I moved in June, July. So that helped a bit to get rid of the rest of the automatic, you know, automatic tracking of where Colt is and all those other little extra thoughts. But yeah, they do fade away, but they come back sometimes. Sometimes I'll wake up and think, where's Colt instead of where's Remy, right? Because, you know, they go outside. I have a dog door and the dogs will go outside. Well, the dog now, just Remy, but they'll go outside in the night and I'll think, oh, where's Colt? And it's like, no, where's Remy? You know, because Colt would always be in the bed. Remy's always under the bed. And I would always be like, oh, where's Colt? It's like, oh, no, Remy, he's under the bed.
So you called your new girlfriend your old girlfriend's name.
Yeah, exactly.
I mean, Yeah, that was one of the sort of, I don't want to say advantages because it's a bad word, but when River died, I moved from that apartment to another apartment because Christine moved across the country. So it was sort of like always seeing where River was wouldn't be there anymore. But, you know, I love where I live and I intend on living here a long time, if not for the rest of my life. So I'm not really going to have that advantage. I'm always going to know where Echo liked to lay and things like that.
Yeah.
So, yeah, it's going to be strange for a while. And I'm literally to the point where every time I have that automatic thought, I literally am like out loud. I'm like, God damn it, brain, because I'm trying to reprogram it,
yeah.
You know, because I don't want to, because it just makes me sad. It makes me sad because it's like remembering that she's not here anymore, rather than living in the reality of her not being here anymore. Because yeah. Do you get what I'm saying? It makes you live in a reality that doesn't exist anymore, which is what causes the sadness.
Yeah.
Or the mourning. There's two different types of sadness, right? There's the sadness of, oh yeah, it's sad she's not here anymore, and I'll always have that for the rest of my life. But it's not something you live in if you're not living in that past reality. Does that make sense, or am I talking crazy?
Yeah, yeah. It's about, like you said, it's about catching that automatic thought and, you know, experiencing it, and then, you know, saying it's okay to feel this way, but then, like you said, it's, you know, it's time to move on, you know?
Yeah. All right, well, sorry to bring you all down there at the beginning of the year, but we're moving from the past to the future, and as you've already heard, I've already introduced my co-host indirectly, so joining me this trip from his corner office, identifying as a woman to forgo his white male gay privilege, William Green.
Hello, hello. Yeah, it's been exciting over here too.
Yeah, I was going to say update us. I know you opened some new stores.
That's
I know
right.
You're using Bitcoin in one of your stores.
Yeah, we went all over Twitter. So opened two new locations, one in Northern Santa Rosa, the other in Cotati. And we just opened the Cotati one last week. So I, too, have been very, very busy. We had some a friend of mine, who I've met a few times, runs the Bitcoin meetups here, show up and post buying a sandwich with Bitcoin on the Lightning Network, because I have that set up in the stores. And it kind of went viral in Bitcoin spaces, so it was pretty exciting. Got a lot more interaction than I usually get on Twitter, and it was pretty cool. And then the openings have gone well. We're raising funds for Canine Companions, which is they handle all the logistics and funding and training for different kinds of service animals all across the country, but they're a local. They've started here in Santa Rosa, so they're a local charity. And it's been a lot of fun and a lot of hard work, and the stores are doing great. It helps a lot when you're right next to Starbucks on one at one location, and the Dutch Brothers, which is a local coffee chain, at the other location. It really helps. The locations are pretty good, and training new staff is always fun. We hire a bunch of people and you always hope for the best, and you get these standout performers, and then you get people who you thought were going to be standout performers that, you know, don't show up to work and you're like, why? So it's always awkward. It's like, man, you're so good. I wish you could like show up to work on time, 'cause then we could have you, but unfortunately you can't stay. But it's been a lot of fun, and everyone's doing a great job, and so it's been nothing but store stuff, new store stuff, and taxes, of course, tax season. So I think now all those things, taxes are done, stores are open. Now it's time to return to those other pursuits, including getting back into watching some good film and TV. And Justin, I know we're going to talk about Dune 2 for our review, but I wanted to talk a little bit. So I watched with trepidation. I watched the Avatar: The Last Airbender Netflix series, and it's while miles and miles better than the M. Night Shyamalan version, it is exposition. It is a masterclass at telling, not showing. And it really, really, really takes away from it. I guess we have to fall in that bucket of live action, like, why are we doing it sort of thing. At the very least, you could tell these people cared about the source material, which I guess is good. But Justin, like, with all these live actions, they're basically turning into consistent flops at this point. You got to wonder, are they going to ever release the live action Snow White, or are they just going to, like, quietly never release it? Like, I'm starting to wonder if they're going to read the tea leaves and pull a WB like they did with the Batgirl and just write it off as a loss, and then we never hear of it again.
I don't know. That's the first I've thought of that movie since we talked about it on the show last season, I think.
That's I mean, how it should have been released by now, right? Like, what other film, like, this is going to be the longest time a film has been finished and not released. Like, there's got to be a record for that. And we got to be getting close to it. So I don't know. I don't know why I connected the two, but in my head, I connected the two. After I watched Avatar, I was like, this is a rush.
Well, you connected
rush,
the
botched
two because...
expedition, exposition dump. And then why are we doing live action? And then straight to, like, where did Snow White come? Like, why hasn't Snow White been released yet?
Yeah, the reason you're making that connection is, besides critiques of Avatar: The Last Airbender, because you know I'm not a fan of the original cartoon. The issue is that people are just trying to print money by relying on nostalgia.
Yeah.
And they're just trying to remake stuff that already exists and
dumb it down. We've seen either in the name of for a modern audience, or in this sort of like, well, this has a niche cult following, so therefore people can't understand it. So we're going to actually just have every character say their feelings, say what their motivation is, and then say what they're going to do and why they're doing it. You know, so in other words, they dumb it down like completely, right?
Yeah, and don't forget that they have to fit it. They think they have to try and fit it into the culture that already exists.
Yeah.
And, you know, we can use any of these labels, and we'll talk about peak woke here in a minute when we head into Life on the Midside. But they think they have to fit it into whatever the prevailing cultures, whatever way the prevailing winds are blowing. And Disney is cutting back. Disney's cutting back. I mean, we've seen the cutback on Marvel, and we've seen Disney focusing more on the parks. And now they're going to invest, like, what is it, $60 billion over the next 20 years or something in the parks?
Yeah,
because
I saw they were smashing up the gravestones for the Haunted Mansion. I was a little sad about that.
Oh, did you go to Disneyland?
No, I saw someone post on WDW Pro. They were smashing it up. So it's like, man.
Yeah, they're expanding the waiting area for the Haunted Mansion because the lines are so long. Because even though, and this is the thing about movies too, people want to keep saying there's no demand. The demand is there. It's just, what are people willing to stand in line for nowadays? And that's the thing. Netflix knows people are going to click on Avatar: The Last Airbender. Disney knew that people were going to watch all these live action remakes. But when we got to old properties such as Snow White, modern audiences don't have as much nostalgia for a Snow White or a Pinocchio. It was all Aladdin, The Lion King, Beauty and the Beast, what people grew up on. So there's all this sort of cost cutting that's going all along now. It's going with things now. And I think, William, this kind of goes to our question of the episode. I'm wondering, as we start season 12, because remember a few years ago I said, oh, the thing they're going to start pushing is transgender, right? And remember, I also pointed out COVID and what was going to happen with that and everything. In the beginning of COVID, I pointed out what was going to happen. Yeah, I would say even maybe before it even happened, I was pointing out what was going to happen. When there was just a bunch of people who were sick in California, I pointed out what was going to happen.
Yeah, when Nancy Pelosi was still kissing Chinese people to prove that it wasn't a Chinese virus.
Yes. I'm wondering if now the shot I want to call is, are we coming out the other side of things? Because reality is smacking us in the face. So that's the question I want to frame this episode in. And that's the question I want to frame this season in. So before we head on, do you have anything else you want to bring up?
No, let's do it, man.
All right, let's find out if we are past peak woken. Life on the Midside. Take a good look around. This life really sucks. Are we just complaining? I hope that this mic is on. Because I'm on a roll here. I hope this is making some sense. I hope that you throw up your hands and sing it and tell all the haters that they should just shut up and smile. Yeah. As always, if you'd like to support the show, you can do so through Patreon or Locals. Patreon is per episode. Locals is per month. We accept any and all support, including, and perhaps most of all, affirmations. So, the question is, William, what is peak woke? We've talked a lot on the show, thanks to former co-host Elliot, about peak farce. He said back in the day where the kid's phone got taken away and then he tried to poison his mom, he said that was peak farce. And we said, Elliot,
we're never going to reach peak farce. Exactly.
Right. Now, the particular brand of farce that has existed over the past, I don't know, half decade or so, is woke. Woke being the idea of saying you understand how the world actually works, but you do not understand it at all. And I want to be clear, William, I am defining woke as that. That also carries with it narcissism. I am not defining woke as social justice, right? Yeah. When people say go woke, go broke, we had this conversation with one of the Midsiders pointing out that just means saying the same stuff over and over again. And it's the same tired story tropes over and over again. It's the same tired ideas over and over again. It doesn't necessarily mean social justice. It just means you think you understand how the world works. Now, the other converse of that is the red pill, where the red pill is the other metaphor for thinking you're awake to the way the world works. When now, what I've seen farcically here, William, is, and I didn't put this as a story, but I was reading responses to the State of the Union, which doesn't interest me, but the responses from the quote-unquote red pill people was talking about all of these conspiracies Joe Biden was spouting off about. Have you noticed that the red pill people also have their own form of conspiracies Yes. that they talk about all the time Yes. in the same way the woke people do?
Yes. Yeah. I think there was a great video this week by a YouTuber that I enjoy. He's definitely a liberal, but he has really good research and points. His name is Short Fat Otaku, and he did one talking about the competency crisis. And that's one example of something on the right. It's sort of it's this own narrative that it's self-fulfilling prophecy, right? Like there's something there about in the meritocracy debate, but the whole diversity, it wasn't an accident that all these diversity in the airlines articles came out. And then there were all these right-leaning news outlets and commentators pointing out all the airline crashes and the door flying off the airplane and stuff like that, right? Like this became a self-fulfilling sort of narrative that, while not like a conspiracy theory, like it's not exactly grounded in reality, right? And I think that's another example that you're pointing out. I didn't see any of the particular conspiracy stuff from that. Justin, I actually was just too busy. I haven't seen any clips or commentary about the State of the Union. I have no idea what was said. That's how out of touch I am, or how in touch with reality I am, I guess is the other way to say it.
Correct. That's how in... Let's stop saying it that way. Just because you're out of touch with politics, I think you are in touch with reality, and I think that's a great way to say it. So we need to stop saying we're out of touch, and we need to start saying we're in touch with reality. Because part of this peak woke, this peak red pill, is people exist in this online digital world, which is disconnected from reality. And they have these floating abstractions they're living as part of, and they think they understand the way things are. The only reason I know anything was even said about the State of the Union was because I went online to try and find what content was I going to find for this episode, basically. You've been really awesome with sharing stuff over the off-season.
The farce never stops. It just never stops. Every time I laugh at an article, I'm sending it to the thread, even during the off season. I can't help myself.
Yeah. Which is great. And I want other people to understand that, hey, use that Discord during the off season.
Oh, right? Yeah.
People didn't decide to hit me up until Zack Snyder talked about the Fountainhead on Joe Rogan. And I was like, so this is all I'm good for? Right? I'm sorry. I'm just looking. The farce never stops. The brackets are always built. I'm just looking at brackets all season. I mean, that's the difference. So that's the only reason I know about that, about the State of the Union and how their responses to it and things. But I have a different pattern here where I think we are starting to see reality push back. Some ways it's pushing back in ways that we saw coming. Others, I don't think we did. So the first one is an article in the Wall Street Journal. Now, this is paywalled, so I don't have the full article. I'm starting to have that problem with a lot of news sites. But here is the headline. COVID in 2024, treat it more like the flu, new CDC guidance suggests. Now, William, I don't know what the CDC guidance is, but I distinctly remember something I said on one of the earliest headlines, not one of the earliest headlines, one of the earliest episodes, if not the first episode we talked about COVID on the show. I read the symptoms, and I distinctly remember saying, that's what I feel like when I wake up in the morning. How do I know if I have COVID or not? Because it was like, if you have a stuffy nose and a scratchy throat and a headache. And I was like, that's how I wake up in the morning. And then that's something we talked about over and over again, is the only way you know you have COVID is if you go out and you get tested. Because otherwise, it acts no different from the flu or a really bad cold. Isn't it insane? One, isn't it insane that it took us 4 years to get here? Two, isn't this a good sign on some level that we're actually just treating it as it is now?
I think that you're right. This is exactly what we were talking about. The issue I have gets to your point too, which is I'm still demanding this COVID reparations. We need COVID reparations. And I worry that stuff like this is we've got some distance from COVID, right? And that distance is allowing for some paper macheing over all of the atrocities that happened during COVID. And I'm calling them atrocities. This isn't tongue-in-cheek part of the show. The absolute evil shit that was done to people. And not just here, but across the world. I mean, welding people into their apartments in China, right? We had businesses being forced to close. The increased suicides here in the United States. There are blood on people's hands. And this article points out what we should have been doing from the beginning. And Justin, we know that there was wild, gleeful speculation that they were going to do the same thing in the name of climate. That's still something that could happen. That's not absurd or out of the realm of possibility. And no one is. Usually you would have people study this, right? And point out all the flaws, right? Remember after 9/11, we have that. I actually have a copy of it here in my library, here in the office, of the 9/11 report, right? With all of its flaws, at least it was trying to look objectively of what we knew and when we knew it and what lessons we can learn. Where is that COVID retrospective, right? The entire political and media class here, they really still feel that they did nothing wrong. And Justin, that as hopeful as I am that they're starting to spout the truth, if we don't have that second part, if we don't have COVID reparations, then we will do this again. There's no way to avoid it.
I think the other piece that you're missing, William, which goes along with the COVID reparations, is the common person. Which I would include us in that class of people. Yes, we have no special power. We have no special influence.
I don't know. I have the power of drops. That's a special power.
Okay. Well, you understand what I mean, right? We're not part of the intelligentsia, as Zack Snyder might say. Who they are, I'm not sure. But I thought that was an interesting phraseology he used on the Joe Rogan podcast. I think the group you didn't name is us. Now, we specifically weren't in the group. We were in the group saying, hey, what are we doing? But when I say us, I mean the normal average person went along with it because they were allowed themselves to be convinced that their life was threatened and that the best thing to do was to go along with it. And I think that we're still suffering those consequences because remember, it's not like you hit peak forest and then you go all the way back to reality, right? There's going to be a decline, just like there was an incline, right? We're going down the other side of the roller coaster now, down the other side of the mountain now. And, you know, people are still exhibiting those narcissistic traits. Yeah. People are not going to want to admit, hey, we messed up and look at all these negative consequences. I mean, I don't like to excuse kids for this reason, but I understand why kids are this way. Kids don't want to work because during COVID, they were just told all your grades are free. And the standards were lowered even more. Because then you could have a digital class and not do anything and they would still pass you. School got even easier during times of COVID.
I don't know. I don't know how long it will take to recover. Let me put it this way. I am by nature very optimistic in the long term and in general. I think that COVID has completely killed college and possibly even just public education in general. I think it's just done. And COVID was not the like the ultimate cause, right? The bad philosophy was the ultimate cause, but bad philosophy of education. But the proximate cause, the nail in the coffin is COVID. There is an entire cohort of children that will not be educated, and it's just out there. I mean,
well, and the more fundamental question with them, William, is not only will not be educated, they don't want to be educated, and they will not work.
Yeah.
So what are we going to do? This is what I don't understand, right? Because I can understand, you know, the system letting you down and you're not having the knowledge. I can understand, you know, not being very ambitious, but literally not wanting to do any work ever. You can't hold down any job at all. You necessarily have to be living off of somebody else.
I see it with some of the age group that my nephew is in. And it is, to me, it is unfathomable, and I can't understand that exactly what you're describing. It's just something I cannot compute, right? Because I see, for me, I see the misery that those kids are in because they aren't making decisions, because they aren't choosing, because they don't choose to produce, to do something. And I cannot understand it, right? Like, it's different than, because they're not, it's not that they're lazy, right? Like, that's not it. It's this inability to take responsibility to be independent and to take responsibility for themselves that I cannot understand. Like, and I don't know how to help, right? I've had long conversations with close friend of mine and Midsider Alex about this topic exactly, right? Like, because he's in the field, I'll just say, of psychology and sociology, and we go around and around it because it's you know, he sees it in his therapy too, and you know, it's often for him it's around trauma, but he's like, this looks like a trauma response is basically the best we can come up with, and I don't know what you do in that situation because there's not enough therapists in the world to deal with this.
Right. And we can't all be therapists. And I will say that's the toughest part about teaching and coaching. And I don't know if it's always been this way, but there are some days where I just play therapist and it's absolutely exhausting because you know who nobody gives therapy to? Me. And I get to the end of the day and I get sick of, dude, that's part of why I'm so exhausted. It's not simply running a tournament. It's not simply coaching a tournament. It's on top of those two things, I have to play therapist. So I'm exhausted at the end of a season. I'm exhausted at the end of a school day. I can teach fine. Look, I can do this podcast. I can talk for hours on end. I have no problem with teaching. But when I have to always be like, why don't you have basic motivation? And then kids will come to me. And I'm more, look, if a kid wants to open up and they need someone to listen to them, I'm more than willing to do that because I respect their humanity and their individuality. But that does not make it exhausting where all day I don't have 5 minutes to myself. I mean, let me give an example. Obviously, I was at work when my wife called me about Echo. And I had to get through to sixth period, my free period. Actually, lunch was right before sixth period. I had to get through to lunch before I could process it and feel anything. So I'm sitting in there in lunch with my door slightly cracked open because there are two girls who always sit in my room because they feel safer in there because they don't want to go out into the general population. And I use that prison pun intentionally. And I'm just sitting there with my head down. You know, I'm not going to lie. I'm crying. And then some other kid comes in the room and just starts talking. And I have to lift my head up and tell him to go away. And I had to be rude. And one of the girls was like, what are you doing, dude? Because the door wasn't open in a way that it was inviting everyone in. But that's the way you have to be. You have to be always on. And that's what I mean about the normal person. The normal person stopped thinking about how things affect other people. And this may seem strange coming from an objectivist or an objectivist adjacent or whatever terminology we want to use nowadays, because I still believe very much in selfishness, but I delineate that from being self-centered. Other people exist and other people have inner lives. And the reason we have a social contract and the reason we have social norms is to respect other people's individuality. But we don't have that anymore. And I have to think that the fulcrum point was COVID. Was it not?
I think so. And I had posted this, it's a long Twitter post to the thread that really touches on this. And I don't want to read all of it. I'll post it in the Discord channel for folks to read because I think it's really important. But the takeaway from that thread was drawing up that when we talk about COVID being the nail in the coffin, but the reason it was so effective is exactly because of the philosophy of education and of the the psychology of raising children. He talks about in this thread that only a slave, a person who is owned as property, used as a machine for a task, is taught just vocational training, right? Like how effective are their skills, and that liberal arts was a means to teach people how to think, right? Arithmetic, geometry, music, astronomy, grammar, logic, rhetoric. That was liberal arts education, right? And that was because all of those were teaching you how to think in different basic fields of human thinking. And that the goal of education was mastering those, mastering your mind, and not teaching you, how to, like the modern education system, how to be a good factory worker, right? Everyone's worried about AI and AI taking over. What things will AI take over? How will we teach people the new vocational skills? That's fighting a many-headed dragon, right? It's teaching people the basic thinking skills, basic emotional skills that matter. And I'll post that in Discord because I think it's a really interesting thread. There's a lot of good comments on there.
Well, yeah, and the interesting thing, William, is nowadays, they're not even taught to be factory workers in the sense that they're given vocational skills. It's simply just following orders. So the people who said they were teaching liberal arts education hijacked that into saying, oh, this is our truth of what liberal arts education is, and you must follow this, otherwise we will fail you. And that led to what you're talking about in the formation. But the good thing I think about all of this is that there needs to be a reformation in ways. Like you said at the top of the show, you think education, or at some point in the show, that education is changing and collapsing. Well, again, Florida is on the cutting edge of this. So here's an article from the Independent Florida Alligator, which I just thought was an amazing publication name. Alligator.com, A-L-L-I-Gator.com, which is amazing, right? UF, the University of Florida, fired 13 full-time diversity, equity, and inclusion positions and ended 15 administration appointments over appointments for faculty Friday. Sorry. It also eliminated the office of the chief diversity officer and ended DEI contracts with outside vendors, according to a Friday memo. The memo follows a 2023 Florida statute prohibiting the university from spending state or federal funds on DEI initiatives, which was approved by the Florida Board of Governors in its final form January 24th. The about $5 million that was previously allocated to DEI expenses will now fund, ready for it, faculty recruitment. And this is what I find so interesting, William. Because to me, this is pointing out how the system is supporting the system. When people say deep state, you know, especially we're talking about, you know, red pill people, quote unquote, who say deep state, they think there's some like grand conspiracy of people behind the scenes trying to control the country. Well, I don't think it's quite that devious. I think it's a bunch of people who are essentially using the government as free money, right? This is one of the things that Atlas Shrugged points out so well, that the purpose of government ultimately becomes for people who don't think they can be productive to take from the people who are productive. And I think this is a prime example of it, William. And I think this law by Florida, right, and we can get into discussions whether are we going to go too far to the right, right? Well, maybe we go too far to the right and then we need to walk back from there. But this anti-left-wing bill by the right-wing government in Florida is doing something good, where it's removing the people who weren't really doing anything.
Well, that's they were the being actively thing, destructive. I mean, it's not that they weren't doing anything. They were actively destroying campus culture.
So it's even worse, yeah. Is your supposition.
Yeah. I think the other place of attack, like if, you know, expecting the right to look at this intellectually, of course, is a recipe for disaster. But it's these DEI folks spout the religion on campus, right? Put all the posters up, talk about inclusion and diversity and hate speech and microaggressions and all those things, right? And then the flip side of that is the Inquisition, right? All the people that are part of the DEI Inquisition, meaning the investigators, the people looking for hate speech, the anonymous reporting, the kangaroo courts, those people are the other side, right? You can't have one without the other. And so getting rid of these DEI folks, I think, is a great first step, but you got to get rid of the inquisitors as well, Justin.
Yeah, and hopefully they'll figure that out. My supposition is simply, this is, I think, a positive sign. And a positive sign, yeah, that, you know, 4 years later, we're treating COVID like the flu. Well, 4 years ago, who was ahead of the curve? Besides us, it was Florida, yes?
Yeah.
Well, again, yeah, who's ahead of the curve here? Florida. So mm-hmm. Hopefully this portends well for the rest of the country.
I think we need to look out for it. We need to be on the lookout for that, though, Justin. You know, we're both old men at this point. I mean, I just had my birthday. I'm 44 years old last month, right? Mm-hmm. When we were in college, that's when the first lawsuit against the University of Michigan's illegal and racist diversity and inclusion, it wasn't called that back then, admissions policy was overturned by the Supreme Court. You would have thought that they would have returned to merit-based admissions. But as we know, that was not the case. They just got rid of objective standards so that they could keep doing the thing. Do you think, Justin, that, I mean, we know it will happen somewhere. If it doesn't happen in Florida, it's going to happen somewhere. They're just going to call DEI something else or assign it to the feminist department or whatever and let them do it, right? As part of the faculty.
Yes.
And what they're going to come up with some way to just keep doing the thing. Because at this point, the machine is unstoppable, right?
Right, but that's the battle. I mean, look, back in the day when separate but equal was ended, the civil rights movement still had to happen.
Yeah.
The battle is always going to be fought. Again, just because we may be past peak woke, hopefully, doesn't mean we're not on the decline. The decline doesn't mean...
We got to be on the lookout for it.
Right. Look, this is one of the things I say about modern storytelling. We don't have any falling action anymore. We think that once you beat the villain, the evil just goes away. We need falling action in our stories for this reason.
Yeah.
And a perfect example.
But that doesn't
fit
in a TikTok video.
Correct. But it does fit in another article you shared, which is absolutely hilarious, where woke officials, right, at the Department of Veteran Affairs. And look, I don't even want to use that term here because that's from the New York Post. People working at the Department of Veteran Affairs decided to ban the photo of World War II. Remember in Times Square where that sailor kissed a random nurse when he came home from
the sexual
World
assault
War
photo. Yep. We all know that.
Right. Well, that's exactly it. They banned it because they said, oh, wait, it is sexual assault. It does not fit our values. Not to mention, like, first of all, William, I'm going to take a crazy stance on this. Are you ready?
Okay, I'm ready. I'm sitting down.
Aren't they ironically taking away female agency by saying this is sexual assault, this photo? And let me explain. Okay. What I mean by that is, aren't they ignoring the woman's desires and just treating her like an object in the photo, acting as if the only person taking
action... The only person with choice, yeah, and actions, yeah.
And it is the man, right? The man can just do whatever he wants to a woman, and she is just forced to just accept it. Therefore, he must be sexually assaulting her. Could she not also be experiencing the exuberance of the end of war and
no,
the men
no,
returning?
No, absolutely not. She
and
is
appreciating
just a
the masculinity?
Justin,
do you see my point?
I do. But I'm trying to imagine how this came about, right? Because, like, was this response to the soccer kiss, and it just took the bureaucracy this long to reminding those of you, some soccer coach got banned from coaching soccer and sexual assault charges, all this other stuff, because it was a women's soccer team, right? And it was a similar situation. A nice peck on the lips of excited exuberation. And at the time, everyone was cool with it. And then they were told, the woman was convinced that she shouldn't be cool with it. And so then she wasn't cool with it. And then now he's banned from coaching women's soccer. Did it just take the bureaucracy this long to actually take it down and you know, decide that this photo must be the same as that? And so therefore,
to be clear, in the
assault.
Soccer example, they were both adults, correct?
Yes.
Okay. And in this picture, they're both adults. So that is a big difference. I want to say that's a big difference. As someone who coaches teenage girls, I just want to make that distinction.
Yeah. This is at the professional level. Yeah. At the professional level. Yeah. So isn't this just the same? They must have just taken them a long time. But Justin, let's be honest. The best part of this is that the boss of the VA found out about this on Twitter. That's the best part.
Right. The Secretary of VA Affairs, Dennis McDonough, found out on Twitter, which, by the way, to me, that speaks volumes that this is going on internal to your company and they're trying to use the public sphere to influence what's going on internal to your, I don't even want to say company, government organization. I apologize, objectivists. Do not get mad at me. I understand a company and a government organization are not the same thing. But isn't it interesting, rather than having this discussion internal to their organization, they had it on Twitter, and then their little secret space isn't a secret space anymore, and the secretary tweeted, let me be clear, this image is not banned from VA facilities, and we will keep it in VA facilities. So their little public sphere coup didn't work.
Yeah, it didn't work. They were expecting people to be like, yeah, this is sexual assault, and it should be taken down. And instead, the VA chief is like, no, this is history. This means a lot to people, and you're putting a different spin on this than an anti-reality spin on this. We have to update the picture, Justin, for a modern audience. We have to use ChatGPT to make it one sailor kissing another sailor, and then they would be acceptable.
Yeah, because it's only acceptable when everyone is gay or trans or.
Yeah. Queer, well, we can use right? that. I know we did. We did the entire woke AI story arc happen when we were interseason here, when we were in the off season? Because
yeah,
it definitely
woke
reminds
AI
me of that
story arc.
Yeah, I just mild tangent. We have to at least mention this because it happened during the off season. So Google has been behind on the AI thing. You know, ChatGPT came out. They tried to release Bard. It was terrible. Had a terrible release. They're about to fire their CEO over it because Strike 2 happened. They re-released their AI. They called it Gemini this time, and they took it is incredibly woke, Justin. I'm talking about incredibly woke. And I mean this in both the little W woke that we're talking about and the big W woke of like actually trying to withhold and change information. It refuses to make pictures of white people. You ask it for a picture of George Washington and he's black. You ask for examples of British royalty and they're incredibly diverse. Vikings, World War II. German soldiers were all Asian women and disabled people. It was incredible.
Nazis were all Asian women and disabled people?
Yes, and people of color. I can pull up the pictures if you want. They are hilarious. And they quickly had to disable the image generation. But no, if you look, we could cover it more in depth, but they aren't recognizing the problem of it being woke. They're saying, oh, it was just an error because it's, you know, historical images should show historical things. So in other words, they want that to happen if you ask for images, right? Like about current things or future things. They want it to always just produce diverse things. So if you ask for,
right,
you know, future Chinese president, it'll be black, Asian,
right,
you know, Hispanic, blah blah blah. It's just always going to diversify everything, in the name of diversity. So it is hilarious some of the things that you could generate.
Well, William, so they're just trying to claim somebody fucked up the algorithm or the coding and didn't put in the right in the exception of actually pull historical images.
Yes, exactly. Right. That's how they're trying to frame
it.
Yeah,
because what you're talking about is something I became very aware of. Because in part of my vegging out over the past few days is I watched all of the show We Are Family on Fox. It's the game show where there's 100 studio audience members and they have to guess who the celebrity relative of the person singing on stage is. And they interview all the people in the audience. William, it occurred to me they are trying to rewrite the story of who America is. And what I mean by that is exactly what you just said. They want it to be spit out that America looks different from a cross-section than it actually does. Now, this is where it's tough because we start talking like this and people are like, oh, you guys are white supremacists. But if you have 100 people, what percentage of America is white? What percentage of America is straight? Why is the majority of that audience
non-white? It's less than 2%, right?
Right. Why is the majority of that audience non-white and gay or queer? Do you understand what I'm saying? It's the same thing with this AI algorithm. It's the anti-reality we were talking about with the peak woke, right? It's people living not in reality. It's living based upon whatever fictional universe they want to create. And I think this transitions perfectly into a story that you brought up. Because you're versed in the video game community, and you shared stuff about Helldivers 2, right? And you wanted to tell us a little bit about that, where a couple headlines here. For some Helldivers 2 players, the fascist role-playing game has gone too far. And then another one, some Helldiver 2 players are inexplicably killing each other for resources despite a dozen different UI elements telling you they're shared. So let me talk about the second one real quick, William, and then you can talk about the first. Mm-hmm. The second one came up because I was searching for the first article that you sent, but the second one blows my mind because it's so anti-reality. Inexplicably killing each other for resources. William, throughout human history, haven't humans killed each other for resources? Even though there have been a dozen different UI elements that can tell us we can share them? Isn't this one headline humanity? So why also, is it absurd?
Also, Justin, it's a game. There are always trolls.
Yes.
Right? Like, there are people... I have a friend who will rename nameless that plays a super old, busted version of Call of Duty because he just loves the fact that that the laydown animation matches the dead body animation, so he can just troll for hours laughing hysterically, pretending to be dead, and it really does look like he's dead, and then he just kills people in the game. And it's he just laughs. It's just funny to him.
Well, William, I will tell you, I am so bad at video games that this is what I would do. I would get sick of playing because I'm bad at them, but everybody else wants to play, so we're playing a group like GoldenEye or something, and I would wait where the resources are and then just kill people. And then I would get killed. And they were like, why'd you do that? I go, I'm going to lose anyway. I might as well enjoy myself.
Exactly. But yeah, so let's get into Helldivers 2. Okay. Helldivers 2, it's set in a fascist, satirical fascist universe, right?
What do they define as fascist?
Managed
though?
Democracy. It's managed democracy, Justin.
Okay.
There's
what is that?
Earth has every cookie cutter houses. Everyone is happy, supposedly, and the same, right? And we've got to fight this war that's going on between us and the insects, and then us and the robots. If you get more advanced into the game, there's two fronts that the war is, and you're this soldier. And you become an Ubermensch sort of soldier, and you have all these abilities you can unlock, and you just go in and you shoot things. And when you go in to shoot things, you can have four people in your party, but you're part of the larger war, okay? It's sort of the war is going on constantly, right? It's a constant, even when you're not in the game, you know, other people are playing the game, and the war is moving back and forth, on these, two fronts. Now, The funny thing about these articles are, if you remember, we've talked about on the show before, there was all this discourse about removing Nazi symbols from World War II games, right? Because somehow that was venerating first of all, at first it was sort of like hate speech, right? But then it was sort of like, oh, you're venerating it. You're giving it power and... you're showing its effectiveness, and somehow that's evil, right? And now we're looking at something that's set in a totally fictional universe, and we're doing the same thing. We're saying, this is pro-fascism, right? Or what they're also saying at the same time is people who are fascists like this, and of course everyone who's right, you know, to the right of Joe Biden is fascist. So therefore, it's bad.
There are people who think Joe Biden's a fascist.
Yeah.
I just want to be clear.
That's true. But Justin, in this article, the thing that really stands out to me is they are trying to code fun as right wing. I cannot look through this article, and I know it's long, but I encourage some readers to read it. I cannot look through this article and not come to the conclusion that having fun, role playing, pretending to be something that you're not, laughing at the absurdity of this evil universe, right, that this game is set in, and having fun as playing like you would be in that evil universe, that anything fun, they're trying to code as fascist. How can you have a games industry if fun is fascist? And this connects to me, Justin, to the uglification of women. We've talked about this a little bit on the show, how all the modern video game women get as one YouTuber puts it, budget cuts, especially, you know, in the upper body region. And they try to defeminize and emasculate the women and make them into, you know, half women, half men, right? Into this amorphous asexual blob and take away their beauty. And I think that this, we're getting to the final form. We're getting to the peak woke with video games, where this is a serious article by a supposedly serious video game outlet, Polygon, well-respected. Basically, without saying it explicitly, they're trying to code fun as right wing. And I just find that fascinating.
Well, this is nothing new. Well, I mean, we've seen this in movies forever. I mean, this is the battle we fought over the Snyder Cut. I mean, you talk about making women into men and taking away their beauty and their budget cuts. and everything. And not that Zendaya has ever been a full-figured woman, but she's still stunningly beautiful. Do you remember how mad I got about Spider-Man Homecoming because of what they did to her?
Dude, in the games, they've hit what's her name? Peter Parker's girlfriend.
Mary Jane.
They hit her with the ugly stick.
Yeah.
Oh my God.
Right. It's intentional. It's intentional. And it's the same thing with people trying to call Zack Snyder's art right wing. I mean, this will come up literally in a couple of seconds here when we play the drop where Snyder's like, I don't know why people call the Fountainhead fascist. Right. This is the same thing. It's the idea of relativism versus, and I don't even want to say objectivism. It's relativism versus contextualism, as I like to say it. Truth is contextual. Reality has certain rules, and you have to figure out what's true based upon those rules. And people do not want to be beholden to the context they exist in. And reality is part of that context. And that's all this boils down to. They have a fictional universe, and they're trying to use it to erase context rather than play with different contexts to tease out what's interesting and what isn't. This is what science fiction and fantasy used to be back in the day. Artists who could come up with a unique and interesting context could then play with it. They're trying to erase the context of reality, and then they're getting mad when people are embracing that to its fullest extreme, right? Didn't we even see this with Grand Theft Auto, where people just started to use it to hang out with the prostitutes and things like that?
Yeah. And that was called, the right was calling that promoting criminal behavior, right? And now we see it on the left, right? A lot, this sort of policing of play behavior and fun, right? It is sometimes fun to play as a gangster or a prostitute or a whatever, right? Like, that's the whole point of role-playing. You're not evil because you want to play an evil person. Actors aren't evil when they act like an evil person.
Well, didn't that come up with it exactly in the Zack Snyder interview, or am I projecting that onto the Zack Snyder interview?
I don't know. We'll have to see in the next segment.
Okay. Well, let's do that. Everybody messaged me and they were like, what about Zack Snyder on Joe Rogan? Let's talk about Zack Snyder on Joe Rogan in The Hopeful Bromantic with JML. Put me into syndication, broadcast to a network station of people viewing their favorite episodes. I can't find a new pitch to throw the studio. As always, if you'd like to continue the conversation with us during the week, you can do so by joining our Discord channel. Apparently, there are a bunch of newfangled features on here. It's not that they're hard to use, it's just that I don't know about them. Well, you remember when it used to be when old people didn't know how to use technology because it was so different?
Yeah.
Nowadays, technology isn't different. They just add new features. And then it's not that I don't know how to use technology. I've noticed a lot of younger kids don't know how to use technology because they didn't grow up when it was developing in the same way we did. But now I know how to use technology. I just don't know how to use these newfangled features. So get in these newfangled features in Discord and share some farce with us. Share some farce with us. Are we past peak weak folk? Weak folk? What the heck?
I don't know.
Peak woke. Wow. Did I just subtly show my fascism? Weak folk? Are we past weak folk? Talking about non-weak folk, as I've mentioned a number of times, Zack Snyder was on Joe Rogan, and there were a few interesting things that came out of this podcast episode. It's 2 hours, and of course, I had to listen to it firsthand because a bunch of people are sharing clips and having opinions, and I just wanted to know what the hell was going on. Rather than listen to Elon Jurno talk about it, I wanted to hear about it myself. So here's the first thing, William. And this is probably the most interesting for us, is Snyder said there will be a 3-hour cut of Rebel Moon Part 1 and a 3-hour cut of Rebel Moon Part 2, and it'll probably come out in August. And this is going to be rated R, TVMA, as he said, and it's going to be much more graphic, much more sexual. He described it as the heavy metal version of science fiction. Heavy metal, of course, being a very adult and graphic comic in the 80s. So then, William, is it even worth watching the PG-13 cuts of these movies? I was already thinking about that when I watched part one. Because I distinctly and intentionally have not reviewed Rebel Moon yet. Because I didn't think it was his version of it.
So yeah, it felt incomplete.
Right.
And not just in the, oh, there's a part two. In the, like, there are specific Zack Snyder, people talk about the Zack Snyder tropes. There were character development things that I was expecting that just did not happen in part one.
Right.
That were on the cutting room floor.
Completely. And the jumping, how quickly it jumped around between things and everything.
Yeah, I was like, this is missing something.
So I was already considering not watching the PG-13 cut of part two. But I don't know. I don't know. What do you think? Is it worth watching the PG-13 cut, or should I just wait until August to watch both rated R cuts?
I can tell you what I'm going to do. I watched part one, and I enjoyed it, but saw many flaws. I think I would like to wait till the full cut of both come out, and then watch both part one again and part two, the full heavy metal version. I think that's what I'm going to do. Even though I'm sure I would get some enjoyment out of the cut down version of part two, I think I would rather wait. And, you know, there are a lot of critics that I enjoy that have sort of an anti Zack Snyder bent. Some of them have a more neutral position on Zack Snyder. I actually don't have a lot of critics that I follow that are enjoyers of Zack Snyder, which surprises me because of their takes on other movies. But that gets into some of the things we'll talk about in the interview. All the flaws that they pointed out for part one, I was like, yeah, I agree with all of these. And that's not necessarily, you know, that some of these could be fixed in a longer version. Other than, of course, people saying it's too long, but that's, if this is a releasing something on Netflix means that you don't have the time restriction, I think, that you would have in the theater. And that becomes an interesting, different way to make a movie, right? In the era of binge watching, you know, is 3 hours really too long?
Right. And that's the difference here, is by all accounts, Netflix has wanted to work with Snyder on this, where they said, hey, make for us both versions and we'll release both versions. Whereas with Batman versus Superman, they cut it down. And then when I watched the Ultimate Edition, I was mad I ever was forced to watch.
Yeah.
The regular theatrical cut. Now, they didn't force me to go to the theaters, but they said, this is the cut you have to watch. Whereas Netflix is saying, we're going to watch both. So if Netflix is saying that, I think that rationally for myself, there's no point in me watching the PG-13 cut of Rebel Moon Part 2.
All right. Well, we'll have to talk to the audience here, the Midsiders. Are you guys going to be okay with us waiting for the full cuts in August? Post in Discord. Or you
He's
can reach out on
nice
Twitter.
To you.
Reach out to me
He's
on Twitter.
He's being nice to you. You're going to have to be okay with it, because I'm not going to review Rebel Moon Part 1 or Part 2 until till August at the earliest. So
yeah,
I'm going to count it as a 2024 release.
Which is more likely, him reviewing Arcane, our co-host award-winning show, or the PG-13 version of Rebel Moon? We'll see.
Arcane is more likely.
Well, both are so close to zero.
So Netflix, though, isn't making all good decisions. It came out on the show that they refused to make The Fountainhead. Zack Snyder pitched it to them as a series. So I'm proposing a new hashtag. Let's play the drop first of Zack Snyder talking to Joe Rogan about Fountainhead, and then I will tell you my new hashtag.
We've talked about it a lot. Like, I mean, nobody wants Fountainhead, but that's what I wanted to do. You know, I pitched him Fountainhead because, like, I've written this super adaptation of that book, and I just think it's, I think it would be amazing. But you know, no one wants to make it because they think it's like, you know, it's taboo. Ayn Rand is taboo.
Well, why is she taboo?
I don't know. She's taboo among the intelligentsia because like they think she's a fascist and they think the book's a fascist propaganda, piece of fascist propaganda. I that's not why I like the book. I'm like, look, you know, I happen to just like it because it's to me, it's a direct comment on making a movie, right? It's a movie about an architect who won't make the buildings that everyone wants him to make and like what the struggle he goes through to get the buildings made the way he wants to make them. Of course I like that, you know, like no movie director. I'm sure there's plenty of movie directors that don't like Fountainhead, but I just think that it says so much. Ayn Rand wrote Fountainhead in direct response to being noted on a script that she had written. And she had been studying this movie about skyscrapers, and they told her she kept submitting versions of the script, and they kept noting her until it was unrecognizable. And then she was like, this is what happens to work. Mm-hmm. You know, it gets noted till it disintegrates, until it disappears. And so, yeah, so that's one thing I've always wanted to do, but I don't know that the world will allow that.
Now, I don't know the veracity of that story about Ayn Rand writing that in response to being noted, a script being noted to death. I haven't heard that before, so I don't know where he got that from. But regardless, there's a couple things here. One, my hashtag, William, hashtag make the Fountainhead, you cowards. Okay, let's get that trending. Instead of release the Snyder Cut, it's make the Fountainhead, you cowards, because there is nothing fascist about the story of the Fountainhead. And that leads into the second thing. There's been some conversation about, oh, well, Zack Snyder and Joe Rogan said some things about the Fountainhead and how Atlas Shrugged, and how Atlas Shrugged is for incels and Bitcoiners and things like that. First of all, Joe Rogan was saying that, and he was saying what people were saying about it. So whether Joe Rogan actually believes that himself.
Now, yeah, he was saying, this is what people say about it. It was in response in the same context. I agree.
Right. And now did Snyder speak out against that? No. But reading the room, Snyder is trying to thread the needle of making a Fountainhead series or movie without coming across as an Ayn Rand fan. I mean, William, hear him at the beginning start to say, I'm a big fan?
Yeah. I'm in the Bitcoiner space, and I just have to say, there is not a lot of respect for Ayn Rand in the Bitcoiner space, just like in every other space, right? She makes people think independently, and I think of all the things, here I am saying that Elon had something good in his video. That was one thing he pointed out well in his video of breaking down this the Joe Rogan Snyder clip, is that part where, like, the Ayn Rand is more radical than people realize, even people who are themselves radical, right? And they often bump into her absolutism on things like individuality and reality and reason that eventually turn them off to her, right? She angers everyone on whatever side you're on. That's what makes her philosophy so challenging.
Right. And that's the second thing I wanted to say in regards to Zack Snyder and these ideas here is, based upon the body of his work and based upon even what he said in this interview, his clear understanding of the Fountainhead, he has to understand that the ideas don't just apply to making a movie or making a building. Yes, those are the most stark romantic examples of being noted to death until it's no longer what you want to make. But doesn't it apply to everything in every life?
Yeah. Yeah. And I think that you're right here. He's threading the needle. And that's something that Elon missed, was because he commented a lot about, you know, how Fountainhead is applicable to all sorts of different things, and that, you know, that Zach is missing the point here and blah, blah, blah. I think he gets the point. I think that that in order to get this project made, he needs to drum up support for it, and focusing on what it is and the romantic ideal behind it is the way to get it made, not point out that it's, you know, that it's so radical and all these other things, right? Like that it's going to, that it rubs in the face of, it's applicable even to all these things that people hold dear, right? Because it is, but like, that's not how you're going to get the movie made. Point out its virtues of it's a great story. It has a great lesson. It's connects to what people are doing. You know, focusing on the artistic side, that's how people connect to it. You know, I've found a pattern, you know, back when I used to run Objectivist meetups in Baltimore, I would always ask people which of their novels is a favorite. And for the most part, people who were more business focused and more entrepreneurial would often pick Atlas Shrugged, and the people who are more artistically inclined would pick Fountainhead. And I don't think that's an accident, right? Like it's easier for someone who was more artistically inclined to get that vision of integrity out of Fountainhead and really connect to it emotionally. That doesn't mean it's that same theme isn't also in Atlas Shrugged, because it is, and it is on steroids, right? That same theme is in there as well.
Right. And I think even to continue with your comparison, I think people who tend to favor Atlas Shrugged tend to be more societally minded.
Yeah.
Culturally
yeah.
minded.
Yeah.
Than people who favor Atlas or favor Fountainhead. Because when you talk about Tui in Fountainhead, he is definitely those elements of how is the culture being shaped and influenced by this intellectual conflict. But that, as you said, conflict is on steroids in Atlas Shrugged. So everything's yeah. there. It's in both of them. It's just looked at differently in both of them. And I think this is another example of what I was talking about earlier with disconnecting from reality and disconnecting from context and having floating abstractions. This is a case of objectivists doing that, yeah. where they have these floating abstractions of Ayn Rand's ideas as Platonic ideals, and they're not looking at the context where, now, they aren't as steeped in Zack Snyder lore as the kids say nowadays. They love that word lore nowadays, as we are, but even listen to this entire podcast with Joe Rogan. He talks about bodybuilding, and he says very clearly that he has the bodybuilding aesthetic, or he says, I have an aesthetic. We know at the beginning of his career, what did he say? I have an Ayn Rand aesthetic. And we yeah. know there's a connection between the bodybuilding community and Ayn Rand.
Yep.
So we know all of this about Zack Snyder that other people talking about this do not. And don't understand that he has always couched his stories as, I'm doing what I think is cool. Zack Snyder's version of cool is his rhetoric to take the edge off of things. Because he's saying, I'm just making what I want to make, which is rational and which is what he should do. But he's saying that to make it non-aggressive to other people. And he's trying to do the same thing with The Fountainhead. This is just a book that I think is really cool about sex and architecture. That's what I want to make.
Yep.
That's the best way to sell it. Because as we've seen with people getting mad about go woke, go broke, nobody wants to say, oh, we're seeing this, we're making this story because we want to teach you how evil and bad of a person you are, or we want to lecture you. Am I saying he should make message fiction? No. And he never does. But if he said, I am going to make Batman versus Superman to make you all consider what justice is and how we should treat a man of ability, would anyone want to see that movie? Or would people want to see a movie, oh, I would think it's cool if I created a situation where Batman and Superman fight and they have a legitimate intellectual conflict to fight over. Which are people more likely going to want to see?
Yeah. Yep.
And I think that's what people miss here. And because of that, I think they miss the true integrity and the true value of Zack Snyder and what he brings to the world and why he is such an admirable and inspirational person. And I think there's a clip here from the show with Joe Rogan where he's discussing his process, and then Joe Rogan talks about process in general. That is so, so important that people have missed. Whereas again, William, they look at the surface level stuff and they miss the really important stuff. So can you play that drop?
The problem with writing and with, for me, drawing is if I have one procrastination I can do, one, I'll take it.
Yeah.
Because like if I look at that blank pad and I look at the video controller, video game controller, I'm like, oh yeah, this is way more satisfying.
Yeah.
That thing wants to fuck me up. That pad is trying to fuck me up.
The thing about the delayed satisfaction, though, is that if you could force yourself to get to the pad, when you're done, you'll feel good.
Oh,
and if you
so
play
good.
The video game, you'll feel... Last night, I started fucking around in my office. I was just watching YouTube videos and looking at pool cues. And then I said, all right, go to work. And I snapped and I went to work and I worked for a couple hours. And when it was done, when I went to bed, I felt great.
Awesome. No, I
felt
agree.
Like I did it. I did something.
I
the
agree.
Feeling of doing something is so much better than the feeling that you have to carry for hours of fucking off when you knew you were supposed to do something.
100%. I couldn't agree more. And then, by the way, and in the end, I did it. I did that work.
William. Mm-hmm. If you follow me on Instagram, you see one of the things I have in my bio is make the decision. I have that posted in my classroom. It's one of my things that I say all the time. This clip embodies that exactly. Joe Rogan is talking about that exactly. Zack Snyder is talking about that exactly. They use the 100%. Phrase. I love how you said that. And I was like, wait, Zack Snyder's in this conversation? Like the way you just slid that drop in there made it sound like he was participating, did it not?
Yeah, 100%. Yeah.
Stop it. You're fucking with me. My brain cannot handle that right now. But Joe Rogan even used the phrase delayed satisfaction. Now, Adam Carolla and Dr. Drew use it. They talk about delayed gratification. And that's the point here. We have created a society of Netflix and McDonald's where you can get all this instant gratification and you feel good in the moment. But then in the long run, you feel worse. Mm-hmm. And you have to make the decision in the moment to do the harder thing to feel better in the long run. And this is two of the most productive people in our society. One of
I was watching
the
Joe Rogan last night calling the UFC shots.
Right. Same thing with Zack Snyder. One of the most productive people in our society. And even he has to make the decision. He described that process where he's sitting there and literally there's the video game controller on the pad and he has to make that decision.
And in the end, I did it. I did that work.
You're hitting these drops at a good time.
Thank you.
And that's the important thing is he says that in the end, he actually did the work. And that's something to live by. And that is ultimately why, William, we could talk about all this other bullshit. All these floating abstractions about Ayn Rand and objectivism and individualism. But that is why ultimately he is admirable. Because in the end, he does the work, he releases the movies, and they're enjoyable. And it is important that he wants to make something we love, and nobody's talking about that. Why did Elon Journal in his video not talk about that there is a major Hollywood director who's been very successful in not only financially making money, getting viewers, and also inspiring a group of people to support him? Why is no one just talking about, hey, that's awesome that we love this book and this other person who loves this book wants to get it made and wants to make it? Yeah. No one talks about that. That's
I think,
the real takeaway
I think,
here.
I hate to be all conspiracy theory, but I suspect that no one from ARI would support Zack Snyder doing Fountainhead because they would look concretely and say, well, look, you know, he changed the ending of Watchmen. He's going to change something in the Fountainhead and we're not going to like it. Right.
Oh, man.
Forgetting that he's so good at the theme.
I'm so worried that the guy who made the ending of Watchmen better is
going to... I'm just saying there's going to be people who think that, right?
Right. No, 100%. But that's the floating abstraction 100%. Part of it again. Damn it! I immediately my brain went, yep, that's right.
Oh, I love our new drops.
It's a good drop. Okay, William, let's see if Zack Snyder is going to say 100% to your review of Dune. Probably not. Because have you ever heard him say something bad about a movie? He's always like, oh, I'm glad somebody enjoyed that movie. And which is true. I'm glad people enjoyed the movie. But I do not like the director Denis Villeneuve. Any movie I've seen by him, people have talked about how great it was. I didn't like them. In fact, I was bored by them. I didn't see Dune Part 1. So I'm interested what you have to say about Dune Part 2.
All right. Well, let's get into it. So Dune Part 2. I can't pronounce the director's name, so we'll just let you say that part. But starring Timothy Chalamet, Rebecca Ferguson as Jessica. We've got some more, I'll get into it in a second, distracting Christopher Walken as the Emperor. Florence Pugh, I think, or Pau, however you say her name, as Princess Aurelian. And a bunch of other Florence great Pugh. Stars. Don't forget Zendaya and her budget cuts.
Yeah.
So Dune Part 2. I want to talk about two things with this movie. The first I want to talk about is a little bit meta before we get into it. This was my first time going to watching a movie at the theater up here since my move. I know that seems weird because I moved back in June, but I saw a bunch of movies when I was traveling and back in LA. And then, you know, the off season started and was busy opening stores. So this is my first time back at the movie theater in like, gosh, 4 months. So I decided to go to the Alamo Draft House, which is a kind of famous chain, a small chain of theaters.
The Alamo Draft House, if you remember Devin Faraci from Birth Movies Death, they were the ones who funded that fucker. So I just want you to know who you supported.
Oh, man. Well, let me tell you about the experience and what I thought. Now, why did I go to the Alamo Draft House? Well, I wanted to see it in 70.
Evil.
Yeah, I wanted to see it in 70 millimeter. Or at the very least in IMAX, okay? And looking around, there's nothing here up here in wine country that it's all an hour drive to get to a theater that actually had IMAX or 70 millimeter, and Alamo Drafthouse had it in 70 millimeter, so I thought that'd be good. And I'm glad I went that. I'm glad I saw it in 70 millimeter on the giant screen with a great sound. I'm glad I did that. But my experience at the Alamo Drafthouse, first of all, you got to know you got to drive to San Francisco, not a very beautiful drive, in fact, from my house. However, then you get into San Francisco, and Justin, you would have loved it. There's a parking garage right behind the theater, so I parked there. I walked a block, okay? It's on the same block as the theater. I passed 8 people smoking marijuana, and just the smell of marijuana everywhere. So, and just like, just in your face. And it's in the Mission District, so maybe that's just a feature of the Mission District, and I don't understand, but...
No, it's everywhere. I'm out in public in Florida, and I sell marijuana now. It's
crazy. It's just crazy. It reminded me of college, man. And so, get into the theater. It's an older theater.
It reminded
theater
you of college with more weed and less Tom Brady?
Yeah. Well, yeah, that's true. So get into the theater. They've converted a theater into a nice venue. They have a couple screens upstairs. The big screen is downstairs. So I bought my tickets beforehand. You get to sit down and they bring you food. They scan your ticket once you sit down. And so I ordered. They had some special food just for Dune. They had special spiced popcorn. And so I got some of that. And they had some special drinks, but I didn't want any of those.
Dude, there was a special popcorn bucket for Kung Fu Panda 4.
Well, this wasn't the bucket. This was the actual popcorn with spice. The bucket was just a standard metal bowl. They just gave it a giant bowl.
They're just trying to monetize everything now. It's to the point that even Kung Fu Panda 4 has its own popcorn bucket.
And during the pre-show, before the preview started, or actually kind of interspersed with the previews, they had different segments that were produced, I think, I would suspect, by the Alamo Drafthouse. I don't know if other movie theaters did this, but Justin, they had one where they interspersed all of the Dunes together as like a Dune recap, and so they would show something like a plot element from the 80s version. Was it 80s? Yeah, 80s version, and then the sci-fi remake, and then this one, and they would kind of intersperse them, and then I thought that was entertaining. The other thing they did was they took different scenes. They kind of had a little fun with Timothy and had his character in Dune watch some of his older stuff, like when he was a kid, like different kind of funny videos of him doing different things, dancing around, rapping, doing this stuff. And that was kind of funny. Then the overall, the movie experience, though, Justin, maybe I'm spoiled. I have to ask you how this is in Florida. So in LA, I would always go to the theater, down at the mall, you know the one I'm talking about, down Hawthorne Boulevard. I'd always go to that theater because it had the nicest screens, the nicest seats, you know, it's you had the seats that kind of lay down, things like that. Justin, these were old school theater seats, like theater, not movie theater seats. By halfway through the movie, I was kind of uncomfortable. I don't have as much padding on my buttocks as I used to. These were not comfortable seats. I just put that there. Dirty floor, all the stuff that you would expect an old theater to have, right? Dirty, sticky floor. The surface was good.
Theater at Disney Springs, so like I can't speak. It's all top of the line, new.
Yeah,
clean.
Justin, all the theaters. Part of the reason I drove all the way down there was not just the 70mm screen, but all the theaters around here are in that kind of rundown condition. You know what I mean? Not the best seats, old seats, ripped seats, questionable sound quality. Now, the sound quality was decent at Alamo Drafthouse. I'm not saying that, but like that's part of the reason I went down there, right? Is like at least I could make sure the screen and the sound was good because that's the whole point. You want to experience this there. But yeah, we're in a bad state, I think, with movie theaters. I'm interested if any listeners want to break it up on Discord. Are you struggling to find good theaters? Like, I just moved here, and I feel like, I don't know, am I always going to have to drive an hour to see a movie now? I probably won't be going back to Alamo Drafthouse. It's a little expensive, and they only really have one movie on the big screen, right? On the big, nice 70mm screen. But still, I don't know. It seems really weird that even at the what should be the pinnacle in San Francisco of good movie-going experience, that it was, I don't know, it was kind of dumpy, Justin.
Well, I mean, it's San Francisco.
Yeah, well, and so leaving the theater, lots of people out. I would say the homeless and homeless adjacent. What were your computer looking for? The transients? The transient to normal NPCs was about 60-40. So the 60% normal NPCs just going about their lives and about 40% transients. There was, again, I literally walked to the back of the block, on the same block. There were a bunch of luggage just... with airport tags on them, and someone was asking me as I walked out of the theater if that was my luggage, and I was like no, and then they opened them and they were empty. So either someone stole bags from the airport and brought them there and then unloaded them and then left the bags outside or something. I don't know. I did not stay to save the mystery of the luggage. But Justin, I was physically in San Francisco, not in my car, for just the amount of time it took to walk from the front of the theater around to the back to the parking garage, and I got the full San Francisco experience. And I thought that would be pretty telling.
I'm sorry.
But
look, this is all I'm gonna say. There's a very specific reason I moved to just down the street from Disney. The last place that's gonna collapse and is gonna turn into what you're seeing is going to be Disney and Disney Springs. So Everyone else may be suffering with terrible movie theaters, but I'm always going to have that high quality place to go to.
Disney Springs, that's true. I'm going to have to fly out to your house just to watch movies. So back to the film. Let's talk about it. All right, Dune 2, the plot. If you know the Dune novels, it follows it pretty closely. We pick up a little time skip from where we left off in Dune 1. If you're familiar with the Dune story, Paul has joined the Fremen and he's learning to become a good Fremen. Jessica has become a religious leader and is going around sort of building the cult of Paul. And we start out with a good introduction from Princess Aurelia, sort of telling us that, making it very clear that about the political intrigue that no one knows that the emperor was behind the overthrow of the Atreides family on Arrakis, and the plot sort of picks up from there. Now, I don't want to go into spoilers. Most of you already know Dune, but if you don't, I do recommend this movie. The effects are good. I would say probably some of the best effects we've seen, certainly this year. And probably last year as well. They are not distracting. They do a lot of really interesting visual things. Justin, at one point, they are on Gedi Prime. For those of you unfamiliar with the story, it's the sort of the bad guy's home planet. And they shot it all in infrared. And so because they have like a red dwarf, black sun is the sort of in-story element. And it makes it stunning. It's very visually interesting. And it's they shoot it well. You get the visually, it communicates the political intrigue that is happening that I won't get into because of spoilers. And it even the fireworks look interesting. And what they would be in that kind of, you know, in a world powered by that sort of sun. And the fight choreography is good. There were only a couple times where I was like, why are we doing shaky? What are we doing? An example of a good fight at the end, Paul fights, what's his name? Paul fights the Emperor's champion.
Batista?
Oh, it's Fred Rotha. It's Austin Butler's character. And wow. Austin Butler has a standout performance. The choreography is done great. The sort of the rising sun of Arrakis is in the background, and it's done really, really well. Standout performances. You know, I was a little nervous about Timothée Chalamet being able to go from sort of angsty kid to messiah. But he does a tremendous job. I still think he's might be a little too skinny for the role, but you know, he pulls it off acting wise. Rebecca Ferguson playing Jessica does an awesome job. Zendaya, again, she was a little weak in Dune 1. She was much stronger in Dune 2. She was a little weak in the first one. Much stronger in Dune 2. Christopher Walken.
Must have been because that threesome movie taught her how to act.
Maybe. Christopher Walken is completely distracting as the Emperor. I don't know why they picked him. It's just super distracting.
In the trailers, he's distracting. It's like you see all these people, and then you're like, and Christopher Walken? What is he doing in this movie?
Very, very distracting. Overall, so negative things about the movie. There are a couple action sequences that, while beautiful, suffer from the sort of shady cam doing too much in front of the field of view of the camera sort of thing that make it hard to follow. I mean, we have such a big screen, and Justin, sometimes I felt like we were at once too zoomed in and too zoomed out, and it's the same shot. And I don't know how to put words to that other than describe it that way. There were just a couple of action sequences that were that way. Maybe it's too much. Maybe I was sitting too close to the, I was in the second row. Maybe I was sitting too close to the screen. I don't know, but some of it kind of, was a little weak. The other negative thing, I already said Christopher Walken being super, super duper distracting. And they take Chaney's character and they cut a bunch of things and kind of put them onto Chaney's character. And I'm sort of ambivalent about how they end it. I think that they've set themselves up well to do Dune Messiah. In Dune, there's this other character, Paul's sister, that they basically have her be a fetus and be the instead of being born and being a character, she's not born yet in the movie, and she's as a fetus communicating, and it's interesting and visually interesting, and I think I don't know, I don't know if I like it or not. It's definitely different. So yes, I think this is a good movie. It's worth seeing. It's definitely worth seeing if you have an IMAX or 70mm experience. Some people are comparing it to Empire Strikes Back. I don't know if I would do that, but it's certainly the best sci-fi that we've seen out of Hollywood, which I know is not high praise, but I think that most of you all would enjoy it. So Justin, that's my review of Dune 2.
So it's not insipidly boring?
It is basically you start out with action. So you're getting a lot of payoffs. There are some long shots. There are some pacing that you may not like. There's this whole section where Paul goes to discover, he finds out, Gurney tells him where the nuclear bombs are hidden from Paul's family because he thought those were lost. And we spend a lot of time there, Justin, probably an inordinate amount of time. You know, they're looking at it, they're talking about it, they're weighing the philosophy of whether they should use them or not. Then they go stand in front of the door, then they open the door, and it's all very, very beautiful. But I don't know. I don't know if I would have spent that much time on it. And I don't know if it connects to the theme very well. So I'm not going to say it's devoid of that sort of thing, but there is a lot of good action and good sci-fi action.
Sorry, I fell asleep while you were talking about that inordinate amount of time looking for nuclear bombs. So,
well, they're staring at it. They already know where it is. They're staring at it and talking about it.
That's even worse. You've just convinced me not to see this movie. So,
That's like 5 minutes in the whole film. So you could skip that
minutes.
Part.
I doubt it's probably longer than that. But okay, well, everybody else go see it. William still needs to see Wish to tell me what he thinks of Wish.
Oh man, yeah, I gotta man up and watch that. How about you watch Arcane and I'll watch Wish.
How long is Arcane?
Probably too long. What? You won't make it through the first three episodes because it's kids, and then they're adults after that. So,
okay. Well, I'll watch the first episode this week. How does that sound?
All right. All right.
I'm on spring break. I'll watch the first episode. Yeah. All right. Good plan. All right. So those are things that are already out. Let's talk about some things that are going to come out in Trailer Takedown. I like to put the trailers in the chat the Saturday before we record. That way you can watch them when you want. Maybe you watch them before the episode. Maybe you watch them after the episode. Or maybe you watch them during the episode. You watch a trailer, we talk about it. You watch a trailer, we talk about it.
Trailer Takedown. First trailer.
Inside Out 2 is the sequel to Pixar's overrated Inside Out. Now, I say that, but I'm not going to pretend otherwise. I'm going to see this movie. What this basically is the main character, Riley. Well, she's not the main character, but the main characters are the emotions. They exist inside of a girl named Riley, and she is turning 13 in this movie. So, of course, she gets other emotions. So, beyond the typical happiness, sadness, disgust, anger, she gets the emotions of anxiety, ennui, and I don't know why they can't just say angst. Why can't they just say angst? They got to be fucking pretentious. Ennui. Ennui. It's a poem. Ennui. Zendaya. Making fun of myself there. Actually, it's the kids who get mad at me for saying Zendaya. I have to say Zendaya or the kids get mad at me. But and so ennui, anxiety, and envy are the three new emotions she get. But here's the thing.
Not horny?
No. That's not an emotion. Also, is envy an emotion? I don't know.
I don't know.
Is anxiety an emotion? I don't know. Right? Is ennui an emotion? I don't know. Right? That's the other thing. But that's a different discussion. This discussion of the main emotions get locked in a cage and then the other three take over. William, is that not just an example of bad parenting or bad psychology if you become a teenager and suddenly those emotions take over completely? I understand there will be moments where those take over and they drive. And you can have a compelling story that way. Inside Out 2 can work. But to go in the direction of they completely take over and lock away the other emotions, I'm not sure how I feel about that. So, even though I'm going to see this, I'm going to be tentative about it and give it a Netflix and hug.
Netflix and hug.
Oh, Justin, I didn't make it very far through the first one. I think I managed to watch it all, but in pieces. So I don't think that this interests me very much. And especially after, what was the Turning Red? I don't know that I could watch another Disney coming-of-age emotion movie. Am I traumatized? Is this my trauma response? Tackle.
Second trailer.
Deadpool and Wolverine is the first Deadpool movie in the MCU. The trailer premiered during the Super Bowl. They had you go online to see it because it's a rated R trailer. And this is everything you would hope for from a Deadpool movie. And then it teases Wolverine at the end. William, this is probably the only MCU movie that I could get excited about right now, and it's because everyone knows I'm a fan of Ryan Reynolds. They know I'm a fan of Ryan Reynolds' Deadpool, and turning him into the Marvel Messiah, Marvel Jesus, or he thinks he's Marvel Jesus, and then he's running between parallel universes to try and save the MCU, you could not have come up with a better story and better humor that I would appreciate. Hopefully this makes fun of the whole thing. I am in hardcore with this. Hug.
Hug.
Yeah, I am not as overly enthusiastically excited. I'm excited. I worry that they're going to take the Deadpool out of Deadpool because it is now in the MCU. I don't know. That's my worry, Justin. The trailer looks good.
It's got a pegging joke in the first 30 seconds of the trailer.
That's not what I mean. I mean, this is, you know, I don't know. Is there a way they can MCU the Deadpool universe? I'm afraid they're going to try with this. That being said, I don't detect a lot of that in the trailer. I think the trailer is doing everything it needs to do. I'm slightly optimistic. I will see this in the theater. So that is a hug.
Hug. Third trailer.
The Neon Highway is a story of a wannabe country music artist who meets a burnt out country music artist, and they go to Nashville together to try and make the first guy's career happen, and then drama ensues. It's not that this looks like a bad movie. The acting looks fine. The directing looks fine. Everything about it looks fine. It's just, this doesn't seem very interesting. So for me, this is a respectable tackle.
Tackle.
Yeah, I was with you. I was thinking when I watched this, I was like, this could be an interesting story, but the trailer doesn't make it seem interesting. And I don't know exactly why. You know, they try to give you some of the drama elements. I don't know. Something is missing in this trailer to make it interesting, and I'm not sure what it is. So I don't think I want to see this. Tackle.
Third trailer.
The Watchers is a movie by Night Shyamalan, but not M. Night Shyamalan. Ishana Night Shyamalan. That's right. His daughter is now a writer-director, and now we have an even more confusing name to pronounce. But here's the thing. This movie looked like an M. Night movie. If you had told me he directed this movie, I would have believed you. So a bunch of people are trapped in like a cabin or a room together by, and I don't know if it's creatures or people who are watching them. And the people who are creatures who try to watch them come out at night. They can't see out of the building, but the people outside of the building or the creatures can see in. And then during the day, they try to escape. This is interesting to me. This is creative to me. I would see this regardless of who the director is, and I'm interested to see how far the apple falls from the tree here. This is a huge hug for me.
Hug.
This looks like something I would want to watch, but it's not something I would race out to the theater to see. It looks interesting. It looks entertaining. This, by definition, to me, is a Netflix and hug.
Netflix and hug. Final trailer.
Boy Kills World is a very bizarre movie. It is starring, and I can't remember his name, the actor, but the guy who played the clown from It. He's a great actor. But it also is narrated by Bob Belcher from Bob's Burgers. That's not the name of the actor. He also
and Home Movies.
And Home Movies and the other one, Archer. He's also Archer. The guy who plays Archer as well, yep. Right? And the reason he narrates this entire movie is the main character is deaf and mute because of what's the accident that happens to him, William, when he's a kid?
His parents are killed in front of him, right?
His parents are killed in front of him, and there's some sort of like explosion and things like that, which cause him to go deaf and mute. He then has to get revenge on everyone, and he uses this narration to motivate him because he had to find his inner voice, and that's his inner voice. This is not played as you would imagine based on the narrator. It's not played as a straight drama or a straight action movie. This is an action comedy. And I think this looks quite entertaining. This is the kind of creativity, you know, it kind of is sort of like Silent Night, which I never did get an opportunity to see, or the completely silent protagonist of Silent Night killing people. So it's sort of like that, but I think it's done in a more creative, more fun way. So this is something that I'm glad to see people trying to do different things and be entertaining in different ways. You could argue, maybe, William, it's in line with Deadpool, that a movie like this could never exist without Deadpool having been popular. But yeah, regardless, I'm going to go see this. Hug.
Hug.
So I got a lot of sort of Ready Player One vibes mixed with Kill Bill and
yeah, I can see
with
that.
A comedic take. And yeah, this looks really interesting to me. It's got some sci-fi elements too, right? A little bit of Hunger Games maybe also mixed in. But it looks like an interesting take. And I was worried at first, like, oh, deaf and mute. Is that how they got a man to be the main character? But it seems like it's integrated into the theme. So, like, I'm less worried about that after watching the entire trailer. Yeah, I think this is fun. I want to see this. Hug.
Hug.
All right, that brings us to the end of this episode. What did we learn this trip, William?
I learned that I missed you all at the Midside. I know we live in the Midside every day, but, I'm glad to be back, and I missed you all. Justin, what did you learn this trip?
I learned that even if you take time off, especially if you take time off, there will be a lot of farce to talk about. Holy crap. This feels like 100%. This episode has been going on forever. Stop it. Stop it with the drop. Stop it.
100%.
It sounds like he's naturally contributing to the conversation every time. Yeah. All right. I want to thank everybody for listening to the show. If it wasn't for you, this would just be me talking in the corner of my closet like a crazy person. It still is that, but you make me feel less crazy. If you want to support the show, you can go to themidside.com/store. You can go to themidside.com/thecut, buy my novel, or you can go to themidside.com/patreon or themidside.com/locals. That's how we keep the lights on. And of course, the number one way to grow the show is to tell a female friend.
100%.
This concludes your journey into the Midside. I'm Justin Amlezeski reminding you that if things get tough, take a step back and witness the farce.
And then, by the way, and in the end, I did it. I did that work.
Nothing? The first show? Nothing?
Dude, we said it all on the show. That was so long. I need a cigarette and go to sleep right now. I don't smoke. Don't smoke.